Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on episode 32, The Founding of Carthage. Previously on The Fan of History, Shamshi Adad V won the civil war in Assyria after paying dearly for Babylonian support. Dido lost the rule of Tyre to her brother Pygmalion and fled with her supporters into the Mediterranean Sea, looking for a new home. Her followers consisted of disgruntled nobles, hijacked servants, and sacred beach prostitutes. Well, Dan, it's a heck of a way to start.
Yeah, and before I talk about anything else, I have to mention a general called Hannibal Barca. In 216 BC, he stood on the field of Cannae in one of the most famous battles of world history and totally beat a much bigger Roman army and became the boogeyman of the Romans. And this episode is where it starts. This will be the founding of Carthage, the city that will become the enemy, the archenemy of the Romans. And I hope we get to cover that.
Yeah.
We're doing a chronological narrative here.
Okay.
And we tend to start our episodes in Assyria. And we'll do that today as well, because we are in the year 820 BC now.
You know, before we start, I have to say, whenever I hear Carthage, I grew up small town of East Texas, and the only rock and roll radio station that was out there was KTUX. And here in the United States, when you make your station announcement, you have to do it in a certain order, and it broadcasts out of Carthage, Texas. So, you know, at every commercial break, it would go 99.1 KTUX, Carthage, Shreveport, Bossier City. So I will forever only be able to think of Carthage, Texas, even though we are not talking about Texas.
When I hear Carthage radio, I'm thinking like, okay, the elephants are going over the Alps, and here is a rock song for...
Yeah. It's Tuesday
okay,
morning,
back to Assyria.
Traffic of elephants is backed up on the hi-fi.
Beware of Gallic rebels in the mountains.
All right. Well, I guess let's
the weather forecast is really bad for you, Hannibal.
Right. Good luck.
Okay, back to Assyria. Shamshi Adad V is then the king of the Neo-Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Assyria dominates the Near East. And Shamshi Adad V is the fifth king of the empire. He's trying to recover from the civil war. And the vassal states are unruly because they had these 7 years when the empire was fighting with itself. So now they have to be brought back in line. And in 819 BC, Shamshi-Adad attacks. He moves immediately to secure the northern border against Urartu. He's raids to the north and the east. Also, the Manians that we mentioned last time gets a bit of punishment from the Assyrians. And the reason that he moves to the north immediately is that Urartu has spent these 7 years well. They have spread out. As I said before, you can't go directly from Assyria to Urartu because the mountains are too high, so you have to go around them. So there's a lot of area to like try to reduce the Urartian influence in.
Right.
And Shamshi-Adad makes this fantastic claim that it took a huge territory, but it's very unspecific. So there was probably no territory taken. He also claims a huge tribute in horses. And that might have been, this might just have been a glorified horse raid.
So he just went and stole a bunch of horses.
Yeah, the Manians imported horses from the steppes. So the Manians were a good source for horses. For the Assyrians. In the same year, the Babylonian king, Marduk-Sakir-Shumi, who stepped in and solved the Assyrian civil war, he dies.
Whoa, that was quick.
It's a bit uncertain which year this happened, because Babylonian historical records will be very poor for the upcoming years. But 819 is the best guess. Marduk-Sakir-Shumi was put on the throne by Shalmaneser III. He was the only foreign monarch called the brother by the Assyrians. He put Shamshi-Adad on the throne in our last episode. He reigned from 855 to 819 BC, and that's very, very long for an ancient king. What but he seems to have done a crappy job. 36
years, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he seems to have been around for too long, because Babylonia is now going into decline, despite having their brightest moment just in the last episode. And he is then the father of Semiramis, the princess who is now the queen of Assyria, who we will dedicate a whole episode to very soon, right before we go to Sparta.
All right.
So now the throne goes to his son, Marduk-Balasu-Ipki. I love these names.
They are fantastic.
Yes. His name is tributed to the main god of Babylonia, then. That's why he's Marduk. Mm-hmm. But then Balasu-Ipki is the rest of his unique identifier. He's probably quite old at this time. We actually have a document that is 25 years before this time with his name on it, because he's a witness to a legal document.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the nobles in Babylonia are getting more powerful. They are weakening the royal authority. And we move to 818 BC, when the Assyrian army under Mutharris-Ashur attacks.
They attack?
They do attack. But you're supposed to be surprised at the name.
Yeah, Ashur.
Mutharris-Ashur. Who the hell is this?
I've never heard of these people.
We have talked about everyone in the Civil War. And this guy was around in the Civil War, but we have no idea what he did. But he came out quite well, because he's the Rab Sakke, the cupbearer of Shamshi-Adad V. And he doesn't bear any cups. He's more like the Grand Vizier. He's like Jafar in Aladdin.
Okay, there it is. There's the reference.
Yes, and you know, never trust the Grand Vizier.
Yeah, if cartoons have taught me one thing.
And we don't know why he is in command of the army, and why he goes to the record. He's in the record as the commander of the army. So most Assyrian kings would just have put him in command and then put their own name on the record.
Right.
But we have no idea why this guy is here. Every year, the Assyrians name an important noble as, like, the guy of the year in the Eponym Chronicle. And this guy has already been in the Eponym Chronicle. Now he is put in the records as the commander of an army, which is really weird. And the campaign is probably similar to the campaign of the last years. They take a lot of horses, they go north and east, and they try to make it look like Shalmaneser III like sweeps through Urartu when the Urartians are just thrown into the mountains. But those days are over, and they can't get into Urartu proper because there are mighty fortresses there guarding against the Assyrians.
All right, sounds like we got some news from China.
Whoa, news from China! In 818 BC, there's a great meeting in China. In his ninth year, King Xuan called a meeting of all the lords of Zhou China.
Okay.
And they probably gave him their approval, because this was the guy that was trained by the Gonghe Regency to become a rightful king.
Right.
And to become a good king, a king of justice and purity. And I think this meeting was to check how he was doing. And they loved it. And, of course, they had problems with barbarian disturbances.
Sure.
And that was probably what they talked about at the meeting. So, barbarians are threatening China, but they now have a king that everybody likes. So, that's good. Do we have to talk about Egypt?
I'm afraid we have to at least touch on it.
Regardless. Yeah, people get upset when I don't talk about Egypt.
But man, just reading ahead, it's brace yourself, people.
Yeah, I would really like to skip Egypt until 725 BC, but I know you wouldn't like it. So, okay, here's Egypt. Pedabas I rules Thebes and the western oasis in the south. He's okay. The pharaoh of the 23rd dynasty. Tukulot II rules some other parts of southern Egypt. And he claims to be both of the 22nd and the 23rd dynasty. Sheshonk III rules the north, the delta. He's of the 22nd dynasty. They're all Libyans. And then we have this guy, Osorkon III.
Right.
I will talk more about later. And we'll talk more about him before. There are also Libyan war chiefs in the delta that are starting to behave like kings because they feel that three pharaohs are not enough. So the delta is becoming more and more autonomous. They are more and more ruling themselves. And the closer you get to Libya, the less influence the pharaoh in Tanis has.
So
maybe you could call them the 23rd.5th dynasty or something.
Right. Is there any... I was just curious. All these people... It used to be, you know, we know Egypt, and they worship the pharaoh. That's the common conception of Egypt.
Yeah, now they have a lot of pharaoh to worship.
Right. But do they still keep the same beliefs? Like, it's got to be changing. Something has to be changing for this to even take place.
It's an interesting question because they are all Libyans. They're not Egyptians, but they, as we see many times in history, the superior culture wins out. So I think they've been in Egypt for a long time now.
Okay.
For many generations. I think they are very, very Egyptian in their manners, but they are still depicted as Libyans. So they are distinctly Libyan on all the inscriptions and the hieroglyphs and stuff. One other way you can tell which pharaoh is influential is how they date things, because they use the pharaohs to date their years. And all the people in the north date after Shoshenq III in Tanis. Okay. So it appears that Shoshenq III is the most important pharaoh in Egypt at this point. And he would have any foreign interactions, if there were any, because he's like at the beginning of the Nile. So if you want to talk to Egyptians, you end up with Shoshenq.
All right.
Okay, can we not speak about Egypt anymore this time?
Yeah, let's just move on.
Good. Back to Assyria!
Yeah, Assyria.
In 815 BC, Shamshiadad V attacks again. So there were 2 years when he didn't do anything. And we learned that that's a really bad sign.
I was about to say, I thought he had to regardless.
So maybe he did something and it turned out horrible. So they were sort of like, oh no, nothing happened. Because the Assyrians never talk about things that go bad.
Right.
But the only thing we know about the campaign in 815 is that it was to Nairi. And that's the old name of the Urartu lands. So it was probably just another horse raid to the north. And we have some records from Urartu at this time. And they don't even mention the Assyrians. So, and they actually conquer the city of Musasir, which is right between Assyria and Urartu. So it's right on the Assyrian border. And this city has had an interesting relationship to Urartu, but now it is conquered and becomes part of Urartu. And this is done by Ishpuini of Urartu, who is the king. He also makes his son, Menua, the co-regent. So Urartu now has two kings, father and son, and this will be repeated in Urartu a few times. So at some point in this decade, I put this in 815, but it's not very clear.
Okay.
And this conquest might have been what Shamshi-Adad tried to prevent, but this is the last intervention of the Assyrians in the north, because now Shamshi-Adad will turn his attention south. Musasir is a religious site that is important to the Urartians, and I'm quite surprised that it has not been under Urartian control all the time, and we will see it slip out of Urartian control again. But this is the main site of the god Kaldi, the Urartian war god, the main god, and his wife Arubani. There is a stele from Ishpuini that tells us of this event. It was actually one of... It's in the pass of Kelishin between Ruvandus and Lake Urmia. This is mountainous territory and very hard to get to. This stele is called the Kelishin stele. It was found by Friedrich Eduard Schultz in 1827. And this is Kurdish territory in the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
And we lost this guy's notes because he was killed by Kurdish bandits.
Oh, wow.
But people knew about this discovery, so a new expedition went out to find the stele, and they were also killed by Kurdish bandits.
That's terrible.
And it was not until 1951 that a guy called Cameron could get to the stele again, because he discovered there was a certain time of year when the Kurdish bandits, who had been around for 100 years... they were gone because they had to tend to crops or something.
Right.
So he went up there, he found the stele, and it was encased in ice because it was so cold. Wow. So he couldn't bring it with him. But he gave detailed notes about how to find the Kelishin stele. And it was first in 1976 when an Italian party went in under heavy military protection from the Kurdish bandits, who were still around 150 years later.
That's amazing.
And they found this stele, finally. And it tells the story of the conquest of Musasir by Ishpuini and...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So now, after this conquest of Musasir, Ishpuini reforms Urartu. He dedicates a new cult center at Musasir, and he moves the cult of Kaldi, their war god, to Tushpa, which is much safer than Musasir from Assyrian attack. And he changes the religious center in Musasir to worship Ardini, a minor god instead. But at some point, he changes the name of the city to Ardini as well. But at some point, the name changes back. So next time we talk about Musasir, it's Musasir again. And now the Urartian religion is really focused around the war god Kaldi, who I think he looks a lot like a carbon copy of Ashur, the Assyrian god. But he has this random feature that Ashur doesn't have. There is a house of weapons, and that's the temple of Kaldi. You sort of have a house filled with weapons.
Wow.
So the temple is just your store for all your weapons as well.
Hey, that's convenient.
So that must be quite a warlike temple.
Right. Yeah, the cathedral of war, so to speak.
And now the Urartians are really on a roll. So the father and son team here, Ishpuini and Minua, they build several more fortresses. That's what the Urartians do when they feel good about themselves. They build even more fortresses to keep the Assyrians out. But they also conquer to the north. They conquer a place called Etduini. They build fortresses on the southwest coast of Lake Urmia, cutting off the Assyrians from the lake. And this, of course, increases their influence over the poor Manians who have their fledgling kingdom at Lake Urmia.
Right.
And the relationship between Urartu and the peoples of the north, there are the mountains there before you get to the steppes. And there seems to be an endless number of minor kingdoms in these mountains. I wonder how many people is in every kingdom. It's like 50 guys.
Right.
Because we get these reports from Urartu that they conquer a ton of kingdoms all the time.
Yeah, it's really just like a cattle camp. They come up on, like, who are you? Yeah, that's it. Who are you? My name is Joe. We have conquered the kingdom of Joe.
That's probably exactly what happened.
What?
But these northern kingdoms are doing something important. They are controlling the northern mountains. Because the northern mountains are under threat. And the Urartians don't understand this. They have no regard for the northern kingdoms. They consider them primitive, and they just want, they don't respect their gods. They only respect the gods coming from the Mesopotamian area. But on the steppes, the Cimmerian horde is rampaging, and this is a massive barbarian horse horde, and they are pressured by an even bigger barbarian horde called the Scythians to the east. And the Scythian pressure is forcing the Cimmerians to raid into the mountains. So the northern mini-kingdoms are buffer states against the horse lords of the steppes, and Urartu is now destroying the power of the small kingdoms of the north. So the safeguard is slowly collapsing, and the northern situation is becoming unbalanced. And where can the Cimmerians go to escape the Scythians?
I don't know.
Only south.
I was say,
only into the mountains.
If you got mountains to the north that you can't go through, you've really got one direction.
You can go through the mountains if you really want to. Especially if they are not properly defended.
Okay.
But this is a situation that's brewing on the steppes, and time it takes a long time for stuff to happen on the steppes, so this will not come to fruition anytime soon, but eventually there will be a major Cimmerian invasion.
Do they yell Krom?
They are not Conan.
Oh,
I have no idea why Conan was called a Cimmerian. Probably Howard didn't think that anybody knew about the Cimmerians.
So he just said, I would just say Cimmerians.
But I'm getting to this point in the YouTube narrative. It's I'm about to do the 710s BC.
Uh-huh.
And in 712, we will have the major Cimmerian invasion when they face off against the Assyrians. And the Assyrians are allied with King Midas himself.
Really? The King Midas?
Yes, the King Midas.
Wow.
And we'll talk about that in a much later episode of the podcast. Meanwhile, in Tyre is the small but very important Phoenician city, the dominating Phoenician trading city of the Libyan coast, now ruled by Pygmalion, who did evict his sister, or his sister fled his rule. There is a lot of trading happening from Tyre, and Tyre is getting powerful. The Assyrians are gone, and that's one of their big markets then, because of the civil war. But now the Assyrians are slowly reasserting their influence. But trading is super good for Tyre, and Tyre is expanding into the Mediterranean. So now we have to look at what happened to his sister Dido and all the people who fled Pygmalion's rule. They travel the Mediterranean, and they have to find a place to settle down. And this story is all clouded in legends. One problem is that the archaeological record in Carthage doesn't begin until about 100 years later than this. But there is no event in Tyre that explains why it would happen 100 years later. So I have settled for this time, because Pygmalion is a historical person.
Right.
And we know he was there, so it fits so nicely into what we actually know about history. But the founding date of Carthage is very uncertain. But the site is amazing. It's a natural harbor. It's a perfect place to build an important ancient city. There is a Libyan tribe that controls the area. And there is a hill called the Byrsa. And yeah, there is a weird story about an ox hide. This is all legend, but I feel I have to tell it. Because the Phoenician refugees talk to the Libyan king. They are like, oh, we want to live here. And he's, okay, you can have some territory, but you can only have the territory you can cover with one ox hide. And Dido goes like, okay. And then she tears the ox hide in a very, so it becomes really, really long.
So she makes like an ox hide thread.
Yes, she puts the ox hide thread around the whole hill of Byrsa. But the name Byrsa means something like ox hide in Greek.
Okay.
So that's probably the origin of this legend, because the name actually means something entirely different in Libyan and in Phoenician. So, and okay, let's look at the sources here. We have Virgil's Aeneid. Mm-hmm. I talked about it before. It's a great work of the Roman poet Virgil, and he is telling the origin story of Carthage with Dido as an important person. This was mainly an attempt to merge the two Roman foundation myths, the legend of Aeneas and the legend of Romulus and Remus.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a pretty good job of that. But at this point in the Aeneid, the hero Aeneas is traveling from Troy, trying to find some place to live. He encounters the very early city of Carthage, ruled by Dido. They fall in love. And in all these ancient legends, Dido always ends up killing herself, because Aeneas has this divine mission to found the city, and this city is already founded, and it's not the city where the Romans should live, so he has to leave. And then she kills herself by jumping from a tower. But before she dies, she says that there will be a Carthaginian later that will take my revenge. So rise up from my bones, avenging spirit, thus talking about Hannibal. But this is, of course, all legendary. Rome will enter our narrative in 616 BC because we can't confirm anything almost in Rome before 616. But there is a new city founded at the site of Carthage. This is a Phoenician city, very much, of course. And it retains some relationship to Tyre. So they pay tribute to Tyre. They trade with Tyre. And they become an important outpost for the Phoenicians. So maybe Dido stabilized her relationship with her brother. But there will come a time in the next century when the Phoenicians needs to leave Phoenicia and go somewhere else. And then Carthage will be perfectly located. It's far outside the Mesopotamian world. So the Assyrians can't get to Carthage. And there will be a massive influx of Phoenician refugees to Carthage, which will make Carthage this superpower it will become later. So at some point in the next century, Carthage will be become the most important Phoenician city. But it's not at this time. It's just a small place with some refugees that try to repair the relationship to the mother city of Tyre.
So, wow. That's a lot that happens at the very beginning of Carthage.
Yes, and then we have nothing until this refugee crisis. But the Phoenicians, in the next century, they will flee from an Assyrian king more terrible than any other Assyrian king, greater than any other Assyrian king, one man that his enemies will only refer to as the Assyrian. I want to talk about him now. But he was in 745 BC, and he is awesome.
Wow.
So that's the founding of Carthage. Now there is a small city on the north coast of Africa that will become really important later.
It'll also be the place where Brennan gets to hear rock and roll.
Yes, and all because of Dido.
All because of Dido. Thanks, Dido. All right, so you got me pumped about finding out more about the Assyrian. That'll be great.
It's a long time away.
It
we
is.
Have to go through the whole interval first.
Dun dun dun. All right. Well, what's coming up on the next episode?
Well, it's time to go even more legendary. I tried to avoid legendary material, but sometimes it can't be done. But now we'll talk about the queen of the universe, Semiramis, the most famous Assyrian in world history. If you look on the web itself, on the internet, you will find that this person is the most referenced Assyrian by far. She's Queen Shamarat, the wife of Shamshadad V, the Babylonian princess. But her legend is just crazy. She just explodes during the years since her time. And there are so many crazy stories about her that if only 10% of the legends were true, she would have been the most powerful woman in all of history. And if all of it was true, she would probably be more influential than Jesus Christ.
Wow.
So next time we go far out and talk about Semiramis.
Semiramis.
Also, the most popular narrative episode on YouTube is the episode about Semiramis.
Well, look at that, folks. You can jump ahead if you want to.
Don't do it.
But no, wait for us to talk about it. We'll add some flavor to this fantastical story.
Yeah, if you listen to it on YouTube, then you don't get Brennan.
You don't get me. That's right. Flavor commentary. It's what I do. All right, please do go to YouTube, though. Like and subscribe and share. All those likes and subscriptions, they really do help us out. Give us a review on iTunes. It would be great. Also, Facebook.com/fanofhistory. Twitter is @TheFanOfHistory. If you want to visit us on the web, thefanofhistory.wordpress.com.
I have to say something about the WordPress site.
Please.
The best thing you can find on the WordPress site is you can find the scripts for Timeline of World History on the WordPress site. It's the full script with everything. So you can read about world history from 200,000 BC. And I think we are at 8,500 BC now. So Timeline is a show written by Shane Sowersby that I narrate on YouTube. But on the website, he writes about the same thing. So if you want it in writing, you can find it there. We don't do that for any other final history stuff. So it's our biggest writing thing.
Okay. Also, if you enjoy our content, please visit patreon.com/fanofhistory. Any little bit helps us out.
Yeah, please do. We need $30 from the Patreon. We have 10 at the time of this recording. So if you can find in your heart to contribute 50 cents or a dollar for every episode on Patreon, it would really help us out. And if we hit $30, we will continue this narrative past 701 BC and go into the exciting 7th century BC, which is a time when things happen. I didn't realize when I started this that we have so much information from these early centuries, and it actually increases every century so much. So the 10th century BC, not that much information. 9th century BC, a lot more information. It just increases. And the 7th century is crazy. There is so many things that happen, and it's still before the main Greek time, the ancient Greece, etc. So you don't probably know much about it. And I really want to tell you the story of the 7th century BC. So please help us out at patreon.com/fanofhistory.
We would very much appreciate it. Again, like he said, it helps us out, and it also is just more encouragement from you to us.
You will get the fall of the Assyrian Empire in 612 BC. The sack of Nineveh.
It's the culmination of the story we're telling.
Yes, it's the epic finale, and it's truly epic.
So
with the pharaoh riding in to save the Assyrians.
It's like a movie.
It's definitely like a movie. There should be many movies about the sack of Nineveh. It's amazing.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm going to say thanks for listening. And for this week, I am Brennan.
I'm Dan.
And you have been listening to The Fan of History.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just a dollar an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.